Pseudopod, episode 156, August 21st, 2009. This week's story, The Leviathan, by Blake Vaughan. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from Blake Vaughan. It was first published in 2007, when it won the annual writing competition of the Literary Mag at the University of Missouri St. Louis, and is the only piece Blake has had published to date. So, prepare to cast off, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Leviathan, by Blake Vaughan. The following has been transcribed from a journal, the owner of which has since passed away. In accordance with his last wishes, it has not been altered from its original manuscript, save where deemed necessary for page formatting. October 3rd, 1903. There are memories I bear which erupt from the formless black of dreams. I still awaken at night, crying out for safety, and, finding myself alone, I hide in sheets, attempting to assuage a cold shivering that refuses to leave my bones. I have given my account to countless others in desperation, but still I know not restful sleep. I pray that in this inked telling I may concretely free myself from this memory, though I admit any faith I once had has long since left me, abandoned in that lake those 11 years ago, never to return. Court of Vess. 11 years before my writing these sentences, I was a fisherman on a small schooner which made berth in the minuscule village of Verdot in Norway. The village actively traded with the larger towns to the north and south, though it seemed stymied in its size, perhaps forced in by the great mountains which arose in a great and white wall around the lake and village nestled within the valley. The summers here were cool and the winters icy. Storms, a rarity in the isolated grounds, appeared briefly over the enormous lake, the most weather in any year being an occasional rain or snow, and a gray fog cloak which regularly rolled in off the lake, filling the valley. I had come to the village during my adventurous days in Europe, and had taken on the fishing work as a means to pay my way forward into the north and east. In my time there I made a begrudged niche for myself, working on the docks as a shipping hand for a short time before earning my way aboard the Chaste Shepherd as a trawler. It was there that I first heard the tale of Der Kroktavian, the Leviathan. The stories, of course, always took place in the murkiness of fog and shrouded night, usually alone on a vessel, though one or two accounts had multiple witnesses. Each of those telling their tale swore to the Lord Almighty that they had witnessed a great fish or snake-like form half visible in the swirling mists. Its size varied greatly from tale to tale. In one story, it was as long as two men and swam vertically through the water. In another, it was great as a house and a half, its back faintly visible as it slithered along the surface before disappearing beneath the black waves. The town drunk claimed that on one occasion his inebriated stumbling caused him to fall into the water, and he would have surely drowned when he was suddenly saved by the serpentine creature which bore him to the shore. Though those who were present saw him hide from the back of an errant floating log, he would not be dissuaded from the magical rendition of his tale, and would dissolve into cursing and quaffing when the others would poke fun at his story. Such tales are not uncommon among seafaring folk, especially those in solitary climes. Loch Ness has its own beast, and the oceans, home to the horror stories of the formidable kraken, but here, such tales seemed supported by the strange and diverse species of fish which were often brought in from the cold salt lake waters. Since those days long ago, I have hidden away many hours in libraries, immersed in tomes and essays of the aquatic species which exist in the deepest, darkest depths of the seven seas, and recognized many there in the queer halls from Court of Vess. In all my literature, these were fishes untouched by sunlight, save when discovered inert upon seashores. I speculate now that they were driven from the deep in a sort of migration, for every so often, on days 3 or 4 months apart, such strange catches would become highly common before diminishing once more. My experiences have pointed to a driving force, one of terror from an unfathomably ancient hunger and a restlessness so colossal and vicious that even the hearts of the thoughtless fishes of the sightless deep might know fear. It was these bizarre and numerous oddities which gave the town a mysterious air, as thick as the fog and as vast as the lake and mountains. Perhaps this was why I remained there for 4 years, casting line into the seas and sharing the terse brotherhood offered to any new blood in the long generational village of xenophobic fishermen. The men of this region were well aware of the seasonal moods of the fish in the lake and capitalized on them. The fishing traffic on regular days was doubled and trebled on those days 3 or 4 months apart when the waters would bustle with life and the hauls were always plentiful. It was on one of these days in August when a younger and more innocent version of myself reported to the chaste shepherd for the day's work, this long before my transformation into a terror-filled hydrophobic shell of a man. The air was chill, but the sun and the effort the trawling demanded kept a body warm. The crew hands, men all of them, worked vigorously with little talk save a few grunted affirmations or orders. Among the men on deck there was an unseen social barrier which barred communication on any meaningful personal level, the closest relation to emotional discourse being a perpetual tirade of crude jokes and grunted insinuations which all those on hand were expected fluency in. Between this and the crew's general distrust of outsiders, I had few relations with the men on board, save a handful. One of this handful, the one most fluent in the vulgar tongue, was Michael. Michael, a fisherman's son, was a cheerful, lusty lad with a great sense of humor. His wit kept the hands smiling in the colder eaves when icy rope cut hands like razors, and the air itself stole away warmth save what merriment could provide, as he provided on board the ship that evening, the men rumbling with laughter as Michael described his night's antics with the town whore. Though the men were prone to such small outbursts of gaiety, they held their laughter in check, so as not to forget their jobs on the lake. I had seen the whore once before by the docks. I was repulsed by her, though I knew not why. Donald and Watson had come from Britain. Twin brothers, they, like myself, were outsiders who had earned a place among the men in their 15 years on the chaste shepherd as hard-working and efficient laborers, each knowing what the other needed or was at, almost magically, so close was their brotherhood. Finally, there was Captain Bulldiog, solitary and powerful, stern but fair, and always open to his crew. 8 lengths tall, and bristling with muscle and black beard, he possessed a dominating presence which the men respected and rallied behind proudly as their confidant, ally, and beloved leader. His appearance was the result of a solid work ethic, the years of hard labor on the lake producing a body that was statuesque in form, like a Grecian statue created in the image of physical perfection. These 4 I felt closest to. The other oafish, lumbering shipmates, almost as alien to me as a herd of bulls would be in the modest fishing village. Near the end of the workday, Bulldiog called the crew below decks to a meeting to decide on our course. The captain began by saying, "Today was a good haul, boys. I think we got twice what we'd hoped to bring in, and we're going to head back to unload our cargo. Is anyone against coming back out tonight while the fishing is still good?" Of course, all those on board could use the extra income. Most all of the men had wives and children at home they supported, and a few needed it badly, though all merely replied with a solemn shake of the head. "All right, then," Bulldiog continued. "We'll meet up again by the pier tonight after we've unloaded our cargo." The remainder of the evening passed without event, though even in those early sun-setting moments, a faint mist had already begun to rise from the brine. That night was thick with anticipation and mist. We hurried aboard as soon as the captain arrived, though we moved slowly due to our night blindness and the fog. The mist seemed unusually thick that evening. Starless navigation was difficult, and only a dim outline of the coastal lights marked the village docks. Nonetheless, the captain navigated us out to the middle of the lake, and there we began our night's work, blind to what fate stalked us in the dark, though each man was a little nervous at the faint electrical current which ran among us. The catch was indeed a great one. Every pull of the trawling nets yielded a full load, and required we haul in regularly. The result was a cold, clammy affair, leaving most of the men arms sore, and the hull of the ship full to overflowing, with fish of as many shapes and colors as to be beyond the imagination. While we worked, I spoke with the captain of his home and his aspirations. After a time of speaking of affairs of the heart, a smile crept across his stern face, and he promised after the last haul to take me out for a drink. "You," he revealed to me, "may be the only man here that I feel close to." A sudden shift of the water caused him to lose his balance. I caught his arm, but his weight pulled me down atop him. For a long moment, I held him, and he held me, before the ship leveled and we stood, sharing a confused and blushing smile. It was nearing the final pulse that the captain noticed a clearing of the fog and the distinct signs of a gale wind blowing across the lake, the forebearer of a storm. The captain bellowed that this would be our last draw, and the men agreed. What the captain didn't know, what he couldn't have known, was the terrible speed and ferocity of the storm which bore down on us even as we finished pulling in the last net of fish. Only half of this haul made it into our hold before, suddenly, the fog lifted and the ship and crew were battered with black, icy waves, hard, pelting rain, and a wind that froze marrow within bone. The sudden torrent of rain swept away where little light of the town could be seen, wrapping the chaste shepherd in the darkness of a moonless night. The captain's cries to batten down the hatches could scarcely be heard over the din of the wind and rain and thunder. Our only dim illumination of the chaotic scene came from lingering lightning flashes and rain-washed lanterns, three of which had already gone out. In the calamity, one of the nets fell back into the sea, where it suddenly pulled taut, the draw rope slapping one of the crew to the ground, and then suddenly snapping off at the railing's edge. The men, myself included, fell silent on seeing this and were at a loss for words. The first of us to move was Donald, who cautiously peered over the side, holding fast to the railing, and yelling back over the storm that there was something moving in the water. The captain yelled out, "What?" Donald shook his head when suddenly the ship keeled forward so violently, most of the men were dropped to the floor, and the ship was, for a moment, peering straight forward into the murky blackness. It was in that moment that I noticed the peculiar swirling of the waters around us, the violent and great waves giving way to whirls and odd lumps in the surface, these recurring shapes spanning several miles from our schooner as far as could be seen by lightning flare. Then suddenly we were righted again, wrenching this way and that with abandon, the sudden heave launching Donald and several others overboard into the raging black waves. The captain yelled for life buoys, which several of the men were already beginning to grab when the ship was flung back from the front as something erupted from the water, stealing our breath and filling our hearts with the dread notion of running aground. The emotions which followed, I have never again experienced save in those nightmares which haunt my waking thoughts. At first, I believed it to be a cliff face or a tree, but when it persisted in form, neither growing forward nor shrinking, I peered closer. The fore lantern of the ship illuminated little, save a wet ebony wall, barely visible by the pale yellow light struggling through the torrential rain. Damn my eyes, I then looked up and up, into the night sky, peering through the blackness for the top of this pillar, but search the heavens as I might, the clouds blotted out the moon's light. I was still searching upwards when there was a great, persistent flash of lightning, which stole the red from our icy cheeks and paralyzed most on deck. I know it was an unnatural thing, an abomination. Black-scaled and serpentine in nature, its neck was as thick as a small house, and its head, reaching as high as the clouds, tapered to a bone-jagged eel's muzzle. The creature's head was easily as large as our ship. The thin outline of its maw was hooked into a bestial countenance. Great, looming yellow eyes peered down on us from that lightning flash before it faded into blackness. I stared on in mortal terror. Once more Zeus's fury flashed through the sky, but its thunder boom was overwhelmed by the bone-shaking roar of the Leviathan, revealing rows and rows of dripping, serrated fangs. What happened next occurred so fast that all I recall are flashes, if indeed it was the speed of the horror which causes my memory to falter. I tentatively suspect my mind attempted to conceal the truth of the event from my recollections, though it may have found the sheer size of the beast to be uncontainable. There was a sound of vast, swift movement above us, and I remember the frightened, impotent look on a crewman's eyes as he, along with the whole of the foredeck, vanished into that ravening, descended maw. I remember the sound of splintering wood as the fore of the ship was cleaved from the aft, causing it to buck wildly back on its keel. I remember my muscles ached and my arms stung with the strain of grasping desperately at the aft deck rail which flew up to meet me. Several men were launched overhead when the ship rocked back violently, their screams and splashes formless in the blackness and rain. Still I clung to the railing on a bobbing half-ship, already sinking below. The aft, and I along with it, was being wrenched to and fro, though the bulk of the storm had now passed. I distinctly remember that cold dread that grasped my heart upon the realization that the wreckage I clung to was being moved from beneath the waves. My God. Even while this terrifying creature chewed at the heavens, the bulk of the beast was still below the waters. Suddenly the lake erupted again, and the roar which followed caused my muscles to seize against the hull of the vessel, and I opened my own mouth. I know not if I screamed or cried or was paralyzed from fear, but I know my mouth was open, for it was suddenly filled with choking black brine, causing me to retch and sputter and loose my hold on the prow, plummeting helplessly into the frigid lake below. The sudden slap of freezing water sucked out what little warmth there remained in my blood and left me in shock, clambering at a deck board which had floated near me. Suddenly I was thrown back again, when the ship I had previously been on was exploded by the Leviathan tearing through the center of the cargo hold, swallowing whole the fish within and consuming the two crewmen who were trapped in the ship's coffin. Knocked back a second time, I sunk below the waves, and I struggled futilely to the surface for air. Feeling a massive rubbery slithering against my leg, I clawed at the water enveloping me to get away from that undefined form, and once again found the damp air my body screamed for, the rain having now nearly stopped. For the longest time, the only sounds were the shrill cries of the surviving crewmen, one of whom was laughing manically, though I know not who. I could still feel the weight of the volumes of water being shifted around me, and I knew the creature was still below us. Suddenly the laughter ceased with a squawk and a crash and a warbling roar. I then began to scream frantically, one hand cleaving to the barrel to which I had secured myself, and the other flailing violently at the water, trying to get away from the invisible terror, though I knew it surrounded me for countless yards on all sides. Voice after voice was silenced, some with the gurgling screams of lungs filled with blood, others with nary a whimper, till I was sure that I was alone, and resigned myself to my fate, sobbing salty tears into the salt lake. I was beyond cold at this point. I was numb from the icy brine. My whole frame shook senselessly from hypothermic shock, and my hands were frozen into clutching claws. The storm having all but gone, and the turbulent waves now calm once more, all was still and silent, when suddenly the water before me exploded yet again, and I was cast back and away by the large, choking waves that almost certainly heralded my death. It was then that the dense clouds broke for a moment, and moonlight spilled forth into that grisly scene. All about me were the scattered corpses of men and fish. The remains of the vessel were torn asunder, floating timbers soaked with icy water and cooling blood. And there in the midst of this carnage, the serpent, the Leviathan, stood, the moonlight shimmering dim rainbow patterns across its slimy black scales, its yellow eyes glowing in the pale moonlight. The moon was but a crust of unleavened bread before it. I did not cry out then, nor did I sob when that vast, insurmountable head peered down and surveyed its damage. I did not even scream when its eyes fell on me. I was so resigned to the death I was sure awaited me. The Leviathan stared. I looked back. For a moment, the world stopped, and I knew that this was the sensation of death, immense, inevitable, soundless, and cold. Then it quietly submerged once more into the cold, stark water. I felt the water beneath me shiver and then calm. The storm had ended, yet I still lived. When I regained consciousness, I was in the bed of the village doctor, who was startled to attention when I groaned with a belabored breath.
"You are very lucky, my boy," the doctor began, nervously looking me over. "Most of your shipmates died, and many of those who were brought in did not survive the night."
What he said was true. Several of the men had died shortly after being pulled from the sea by the crew of Fearful Nancy, which spotted our wreck while traveling out that next morning. Donald, his brother Watson, Michael, the captain, and I were the only ones pulled alive from the bloody remains of the chased shepherd. Of those who survived, Donald and Watson were most permanently scarred. When I was well enough to walk again, I found them a few rooms down from my own. Donald's fall and subsequent struggle for life had permanently crippled one of his legs. When I spoke with them, I noticed that their interactions were clumsy, interrupting and becoming frustrated with one another as though the trauma had robbed the two of them of their preternatural bond. Michael and Captain Boldyag were mostly unaffected, like myself, though I sensed a chip on the captain's shoulder, his proud and boisterous demeanor now somewhat hushed and undercut by a humble, emotion-filled tone. The doctor said that I was fortunate to have made a full recovery, bodily at least. After that night, the men of the village refused to associate with me. Despite their own tales of the Leviathan, they saw my rambling about the horrors that I witnessed as madness, and when I would approach them, they would act awkward, stumbling over words and acting terrified of physical contact, lest I infect them with my outsider's insanity. The other four survivors refused to support my claims. Donald and his brother returned to England. Michael and Boldyok began spending their days at the bars, drowning themselves in rum and whiskey. I was angry at first at this betrayal, but when I confronted the captain, wallowing in his bar, he rose up against me with a face that held such a distraught mix of emotions that I could not tell if he would strike me down or sob. I walked out of the bar, and it was not long after that encounter that I left Viterdot and fled to my old home in America. I know not how I managed to get across the ocean to return home without truly going mad, save through the grace of God and a daily allotment of alcohol strong enough to blind a drunkard.
I've talked before, at length, about my love for something horrible in the sea stories. It's the thing I key off most in Lovecraft's work, in fact, the deep ones and the idea that something far, far older than we ever thought possible sits just off the coast, waiting. The Foghorn by Ray Bradbury is one of my favourite short stories for that same reason, as is The Kraken Wakes by John Wyndham, which I would argue is probably his best and most frequently overlooked novel. What Blake's done here is evoke not only the spirits of Bradbury and Lovecraft and Wyndham, but also apply a very personal, frayed edge to the story. The damage the Leviathan inflicts on the survivors is arguably more horrific than the men it kills, an immense black full stop in their lives, a point beyond which nothing will ever be the same again. It doesn't matter that they aren't believed. It doesn't even matter that they survived. The only thing that matters is that for the first and only time, they have been given absolute, unequivocal proof that the Leviathan is real, and in doing so, have realized everything in their world is built on sand, or perhaps more appropriately, an impossibly deep, impossibly dark, impossibly alive ocean. This, ultimately, is a story about what happens when you push too far into the shadows and something pushes back. In the narrator's situation, I'd move inland too. Where I could ask for your money in safety. The facts are these. We rely on you to pay our authors, our hosting costs, basically everything. We are an engine, and your generosity is the fuel, and you have never, not once, let us down. If you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you, we appreciate it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Our closing music is by Hopeful Machines, a side project of Ego Likeness. You can find out more at egolikeness.com. Please join us next week for a very different perspective on horror in Wave Goodbye by Felicity Broomfield. In the meantime, if you want blood, Pseudopod's got it.